welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out, presented by War Scholar. Today I speak with John Wukowicz, who's written a book on Notre Dame chaplains who served in World War II. He's gone through hundreds of their letters and other writings to put together a story, very fascinating story about what they went through in World War II on all the various fronts. So this will be a very interesting episode with a lot of human stories. And so thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with John Wukowicz, author of Soldiers of a Different Cloth, Notre Dame Chaplains in World War II. Thank you for speaking with me.
Well, it's a pleasure, Chris. Anytime I have someone interested in the topic of this book, it's sure something I like to take advantage of. So thank you for the invitation.
Oh, yeah. So first, tell me, how did you get into studying and writing on this topic?
Well, I've been writing World War II history for 25 years, 30 years. The last half of that, the books. And a few years back, I'm a graduate of Notre Dame, and a few years back I was reading a history of Notre Dame. I'm one of those history nerds who can read almost anything, obviously. Mm-hmm. I'm reading that for pleasure, right? And it was written in 1948. The author mentioned that during World War II there were 30-some chaplains from Notre Dame, and that maybe someday someone will write their story. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, I'll be happy to if they did something. You know, if they're all stateside posts, that's mm-hmm. not going to be a compelling story. Mm-hmm. But if they were spread throughout both theaters, European and Pacific, then I thought maybe we've got something. So I started to examine it, went down to Notre Dame and the other archives, and found out that these chaplains had written letters to their superior at Notre Dame. It wasn't a mandatory, like, monthly basis, but, you know, every so often. And one guy, Father Barry, did write pretty much every month. And I read some of those letters and found out right away, oh boy, there's a great story here. You know, these guys were at North Africa, Sicily, Italy, southern France, Normandy. One guy parachuted into Normandy on D-Day, Dachau, the Philippines, then Death March. Okinawa, Iwo Jima, they were all over. And so that's how the interest in that story was started.
Okay, so why don't we talk about the book then? Tell me how do you break it down? Is it by chaplain or chronological? How do you work it out?
No, what I did, there were 36 people involved, including, I'm sorry, 35, including six missionaries. They weren't technically chaplains, mm-hmm. but they were on their way to the missions in India when they stopped over in Manila 3 days before the war broke out. They were trapped and spent the war in prison camp, and so I included them. Mm. Now, with that kind of a number, you just can't write a coherent book trying to focus, you know, on all of them. And so what I did was I selected four or five and told the story of basically World War II through those four or five. And that way, you know, people who read it can sort of keep things straight. So I started out with how the war started. Mm-hmm. These missionaries actually involved in the first day of combat in the Philippines, which was December 8th. In the Philippines on the other side of the international dateline. And then I go over to Europe where the chaplains started arriving and then back to the Pacific and so on. Always telling it through these few main characters, I'll call them. Mm-hmm. Even though it's not a fiction book, everything is based on the archive letters and reports and everything else that I uncovered. So that way, you make it manageable for the reader. I do mention every chaplain, especially in an appendix with their picture and where they were stationed, et cetera, like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I just focus on those five or six people.
Mm-hmm. How much did these chaplains keep in touch with each other during the war? Or was it all communication through their superior and back and forth?
Yeah, it was mainly through their superior. They rarely did I find a letter from one chaplain to another.
Mm-hmm.
It was, they might meet at a base, a back area base in the Pacific for a day or so, or if two chaplains aboard ships mm-hmm. that pulled into a harbor, they might see each other. But the letters were really non-existent to each other.
Mm-hmm.
It was mainly through Father Steiner, their superior at Notre Dame. They would say, well, how's Father so-and-so doing? Or have you heard about this person?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they sort of kept in contact. They're so busy with all of their activities that many of them lack the time to probably put much time into it, though.
Mm-hmm.
So these guys, I found out, were exceptionally busy on the war front.
Yeah, I can imagine. So were they all, so how did they break down as far as graduates of Notre Dame who were chaplains versus chaplains for Notre Dame who had been educated elsewhere?
They either were their chaplains who were members of the Holy Cross congregation. That's the organization that still operates and runs Notre Dame today.
Mm-hmm.
Congregation of Holy Cross, it's called. They either belonged to that and therefore served on campus in one capacity or another, teacher or whatever,
mm-hmm.
or they were graduates like I am, who after they graduated became priests.
Mm-hmm.
And those were largely diocesan priests. Just working, and one was in the Toledo Diocese and worked out of parishes in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
There were only three or four of those. Most of them were the Holy Cross priests.
Mm-hmm. So,
but they all had that tie to Notre Dame. They all graduated from Notre Dame, as most of the Congregation of Holy Cross pretty much sends their members to the University of Notre Dame. They live right there and get their degree. So they all were alumni of the university, but most of them belong to the Congregation of Holy Cross.
So I saw in the book description there's a wide range of ages among them. How about range of rank?
Yeah, the oldest was in his early 50s when he started. The youngest would have been upper 20s. And the reason for that is that, like soldiers in World War II, a lot of them were 17, even 18, 19. But chaplains had to have gone through the educational process of becoming a priest, which takes 11 years right there, kind of in high school. I'm thinking because some of them went to seminary in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 11 years right there. And then they had to have 3 years of experience as a priest. So you're talking, they're at least 10 years older than most of the soldiers they served.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I say 27, 28 would be the youngest of the chaplains. They average right around mid-30s. Being a chaplain was tough, and the 51-year-old had a rough go of it in training camp because they all went through the same training as the average boots or the average Marine or anything like that. And so they had to endure that.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be pretty rough for them.
So did they all join the military? Well, how did they break down between Army and Navy, or was there any?
It really was their preference. Mm-hmm. They would put in, they would first have to ask their superior at Notre Dame permission to enter the military.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would choose, do I want Army, Navy, etc.
Mm-hmm.
So they broke down to there were more Army chaplains than anything, but then again, the proportion of armed forces in World War II was largely Army.
Right.
Second was Navy, and third was Marines, although Marines were part of the Navy.
Right.
Although you don't want to tell that to a Marine today. They will not believe that.
Yeah.
They claim we're not a part of the Navy. We're the Marines.
Yeah.
But a chaplain either went to chaplain school for the Army chaplain school or Navy chaplain school.
Mm.
They were in different places. The Army chaplain school was mainly at Harvard University, the Navy chaplain school at William and Mary University.
Mm. Interesting. So I guess when they did join, that would mean they left sort of an open or a void of some sort in their parish.
Yeah, that's right. And that was sort of a quandary for their superior at Notre Dame and other top officials in the Holy Cross Order. How do they replace some of these men? They needed them to serve in some parishes or teachers at Notre Dame or administrators at Notre Dame, but then they said, well, you know, the rest of the country is sacrificing,
mm-hmm.
and so we've got to do our part as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they just made do the best they could. But yeah, when you have 30-some people removed from whatever their jobs were, it's not always easy to replace that.
Mm-hmm.
They just did the best. But at the same time, hey, we're helping our country. And these chaplains went in large part because they wanted to do precisely that, help their country in time of war. And so this is giving them the chance to do so.
So how many of them were in the front lines, and how many, maybe the older ones, had more staff positions possibly, you know, organizing other chaplains? Activities.
I'd say two-thirds of that number were in the combat zone, the front lines.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other, obviously the one-third would be behind the scenes. And when I say behind the scenes, they might be at bases in the Pacific that had already been taken by the Marines or the Army infantry.
Mm-hmm.
And they were there being chaplains for men stationed at those bases.
Mm-hmm.
Or they would also take care of Native Islanders. Some were in hospitals on the home front, just one or two. One guy was, I'll say, stuck in Canada. He was Canadian by birth, and he became a chaplain in the Canadian Army, but mm-hmm. they never let him go overseas, and he was pretty ticked off about that. He wanted to get overseas badly, and he kept pestering his superior, help me convince these people, let me get over, but he never did quite get overseas.
Interesting. Was he the only of the ones you talk about, was he the only one who wasn't a U.S. citizen?
He was the only one who never requested to leave the United States and never went. There were one or two others who, when they were assigned, like the hospital post,
mm-hmm.
or one guy was assigned in the Caribbean, they didn't ask for any transfer to the war zone. They just accepted it as their duty.
Because
mm-hmm. these guys are, again, used to being in the religious life, and when your superior tells you to do something, you just do it. And that's what they did. But being human beings, others put up quite a fuss. I want to get over there. Well, Father so-and-so is in Italy, why can't I be there? That kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, these chaplains struck me as every bit of human beings that all of us are. You know, they had the same feelings, emotions, and anger, and joy as anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I use one of them in particular to show that, Father Joseph Berry.
Mm-hmm.
Who had an incredible over 500 days in combat in Europe.
Wow.
Where he went with the same regiment of the 45th Infantry Division. They were involved in the fighting to take Sicily then over to the Italian mainland, at Anzio, Salerno, Monte Cassino, liberated Rome, over to southern France, and into Germany, and ended up at Dachau concentration camp. And his letters blew me away. And this guy, 5'3" tall, was all Father Barry was, but a dynamo of action. I interviewed some of the members, some of the soldiers he served, and unanimously they said, "We'll never forget Father Barry." Because in the thick of the fighting, with the shells raining down and mortars were exploding near us and bullets nipping at our feet and mud and rain and everything all over, into the ditch slid Father Barry asking us, "You guys need anything?" I mean, he was right there with everything. And he put all of this into his letters back to his superior, long letters about what they were experiencing. And never once did I come across, in all of his many letters, any instance where he called these men soldiers. He always said, "They're my boys, they're my lads." Those are the two phrases. It's almost like he consciously did that because they were boys before the war. They entered the military not because they wanted to make it a career, but because they needed to fight for their country, and after that they'd return to civilian life. Well, Father Barry thought of them as boys and lads because he wanted to do everything he could so that after the war they would return as whole and as possibly close to being those same boys that they were when they entered. An impossible task, obviously, because once you've experienced combat, how can you not be changed? But he was determined, I want to return them whole and as innocent as possible. Yeah. It was a struggle he had all the time. But his letters were so powerful. He would always tell how, "Father Steiner, my boys are really suffering this week." And then he'd explain what they went through. Never once did he say, "Oh yeah, I went through all that as well." Because every soldier told me, "Father Barry did the same thing we all did. When we were under artillery fire, he was too. And he'd still run out and help someone who was dying and cradle him in his arms and administer last rites." And I said, "I don't know how this guy could do it armed only with a Bible and not a rifle." I mean, they just heaped praise after praise on Father Barry.
Yeah, I imagine these chaplains, in a sense, dealt with more emotional weight on them, more emotional issues than the average soldier. They sought it out.
Yeah, I agree. That's a great comment. They sure did, because when you think of it, these guys were men of peace. I mean, we're all supposed to be, but you know how that goes. But these guys were committed to peace and love and respect for human life. And they're serving in an arena just that opposite of everything. Death and bloodshed and gore and hatred and that kind of thing. And that tore away at some of them. Father Barry had a little trouble with that, actually. Nothing major, he didn't have any problems after the war. But he tried to balance that. I'm here to help these guys, and I'm serving in the most violent arena possible, trying to preach brotherhood and love. And then, that would get to them. And then these young kids would come up to them with problem after problem after problem. "Father, can you do something to help me out? My girlfriend just wrote this Dear John letter. Hey, we're breaking it off. It's a Dear John letter. And how do I handle this? Or my dad back home is beating my mom. How do I handle that? And I'm across the world from them." So they had to listen to all of the issues the soldiers faced and still try and keep their morale up for the coming combat action, keep the soldiers' morale up, and theirs as well, I'm sure. So it was a difficult balancing act of preaching that love and brotherhood in such a violent arena.
Did Father... you make any mention of what it felt like to go through Italy, and I don't know if you went through the Vatican or close to it.
Yeah, Father Gary, when they, as they neared Rome, a lot of the soldiers would come up to him and ask him, you know, about the Pope and stuff like that. And Father Gary wrote in one of letters back to Father Steiner, as the way my boys look at it, all I have to do is go up to the Vatican, knock on the door, and ask, is the Pope in? I love that comment. You know, can the Pope come out and play, kind of a thing. He said they all thought that's all I had to do. You know, they didn't realize the formality of approaching the Pope.
Yeah.
Now, he did get a meeting with the Pope, who was Pope Pius XII at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a meeting of maybe 50 chaplains, and the Pope gave quite an emotional talk about how much he appreciated what they were doing, and then went up to each chaplain and said something to them,
mm-hmm.
To Father Barry. You know, he said, oh, I've been to Notre Dame, I enjoyed it very much, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So Father did get to meet him, but not because he knocked on the Pope's front door. Yeah, that, a lot of the letters you don't laugh at or chuckle when you're researching this material, but that was one that
yeah.
probably the archivist looked up at me and went, quit laughing, you know, that kind of a thing. But it was great to see that comment. So that's what struck me, too, with this. All of these letters, you really get to the humanity, the human angle of combat. What they're thinking and observing. And most soldiers, when they wrote letters, they don't want to worry their parents. So they don't get too much into anything. These chaplains didn't have that feeling in their letters to their superior anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The letters they wrote home were a different story. But to their superior, it was certainly Father Barry and a couple others just unloaded everything. You know, here's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
They still could not mention where they were. The censor would eliminate that.
Mm-hmm.
But these priests, more accustomed to digging into matters than common soldiers, I suppose, really got into the feelings and the emotions and that part of the war. You get that so clearly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Father Barry at Dachau, another powerful moment. But every chaplain faced a powerful moment somewhere along the way if they were in the front lines, as two-thirds of them were.
Mm-hmm. Did you read any letters or anything they wrote after the war to get a sense of if they had trouble reacclimating?
Yeah, I did. And no, there was one priest who sort of had a drinking problem.
Mm-hmm.
Father Barry, because of what he saw, especially at Dachau concentration camp, and it was the first of Hitler's concentration camps. Time magazine said its mere name meant terror throughout Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the first unit to enter Dachau. Father Barry's unit liberated Dachau.
Mm-hmm.
And they were there, and he didn't want to see this stuff. And he said, my gosh, it's too hideous. But he said, no, I have a duty as chaplain. I must see this and record this.
Mm-hmm.
So he did. He tapped one of the inmates at the Dachau as a guide, and he took him through all parts of the camp, including the crematoria and gas chambers and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that affected Father Barry. I mean, imagine him staring at a boxcar packed with bodies of all ages, you know, just coming out of the gas chambers, and he's staring at that. It's almost like a man of God staring into the abyss of hell.
Mm-hmm.
And the thoughts that went through his mind as he's doing that.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of affected him. What he needed after the war, he was stationed for a little bit at Notre Dame, and then at a high school in Akron, Ohio, Archbishop Hogan High School, a big high school there, and where he worked with high school age students, obviously, and that rejuvenated his optimism about youth. He hadn't totally lost it. He never did. But the effects of Dachau were sort of cleansed by his experiences after the war.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't come across any chaplain who had serious mental issues, just the one with a little bit of drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be about it.
Interesting. So let me ask about the letters that you used. You mentioned the censors. Did you read the original versions, or did you read the censored versions?
These were the originals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Censors tended to leave chaplains a little bit alone.
Mm-hmm.
They were more concerned about the men in their unit, you know, the privates and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these letters have never been read before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as a researcher, you go into archives and you get some of these folders, and you know that researchers have been there before because they're disheveled and out of order, and you know, maybe a stain on one letter or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But these, it was like, whoa, they're stacked nice and neat, no creases or folded edges or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sitting there thinking, I'm the first guy who's ever read these since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all the original, handwritten or typewritten. Some of them had access to typewriters.
Mm-hmm.
That were sent to Father Steiner.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 600 letters at least, maybe 800 for all I know. I never added them up.
Mm-hmm.
But it provided fascinating reading. As did some of their reminiscences. Some wrote about their time in war.
Mm-hmm.
Father Barry gave a long interview. A couple of the missionaries who were in prison camp in the Philippines wrote 90 to 100 typewritten page memoirs of their time at Los Baños, a prisoner camp,
mm-hmm.
and how they were rescued by paratroopers that dropped into camp to free them because the Japanese were going to slaughter the whole camp within a day or so.
Oh, wow.
And so MacArthur ordered a daring paratroop drop into the camp, and they rescued every person, man, woman, and child in Los Baños, which is near Manila in the Philippines,
mm-hmm.
and whisked them away to safety. It was funny. One of the missionaries, a brother, he's called, wasn't sure what was going on with all the commotion when these paratroopers were dropping, and I didn't know what was happening until suddenly I heard one of these soldiers cussing like a good old American. So then I knew I was okay. So even religious get a kick out of cussing, I suppose. At least that one did.
Yeah.
I said, man, I knew these were Americans if they're cussing like that. So they were all taken to safety. An amazing raid.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I wanted to include these missionaries, because of their time in prison camp.
Yeah.
Two other priests, chaplains in the Philippines, were on the Bataan Death March. Father Duffy, an appropriate name for Notre Dame, I guess, the Irish, and Father Carberry. And Father Duffy, they were both stationed in the Philippines before the war broke out. Father Duffy was bayoneted by a cruel guard two or three times and left for dead on the trail, on the death march.
Mm-hmm.
But some Filipinos came along and dragged his body into the jungle and then nursed him back to health. Then he was subsequently captured, spent the rest of the time in prison camp, then was transported to Japan on what are called the hell ships.
Cool.
And maybe you've heard of those. They were called hell ships. They were transports taking prisoners from the Philippines to Japan. And they were called that because of the deplorable conditions. A lot of men died on it.
Mm-hmm.
But Father Duffy was in the hell ship with Father Carberry, the same hell ship.
Mm-hmm.
Father Carberry died with Father Duffy, the other Notre Dame priest, administering last rites to him.
Yeah.
And then the Japanese tossed Father Carberry's body overboard, and that was that.
Mm-hmm.
Father Duffy survived and made it back to Ohio to serve out his time to be a parish priest for the rest of his life.
Yeah. What other resources did he use besides the letters and these memoirs and such? Were there other resources you used for the research?
Yeah, at Notre Dame there were four different archives that I used. Mm-hmm. There was one for the main university archives, one for the Holy Cross priests, a third for the Holy Cross brothers, and then a fourth for the Holy Cross nuns, the two nuns that were in prison camp. After that, I used government records. And, the National Archives are in College Park, Maryland, not far from where you are. Mm-hmm. And anymore, you can just go on that website called Fold 3. I pay a little price for it. It's very inexpensive. And I just downloaded all the records that I needed from that. Mm-hmm. The American Army Chaplain Museum in South Carolina, Fort Jackson. Mm-hmm. Had some great material on some of these chaplains. Then the rest would be secondary accounts. Like at Los Baños prison camp, there were some really great books written by civilians who were in that camp. Mm-hmm. So I learned about a lot of the life that these chaplains experienced from those books. Mm-hmm. In Europe, the units at Father Barry and Father Sampson ministered to, soldiers wrote their accounts, or I called some of them. I was able to interview some. Father Sampson, the other main chaplain in Europe, joined the paratroops, the 101st Airborne. Mm-hmm. And then he found out he was going to have to jump. He didn't think a chaplain had to parachute. So he said, I would have never volunteered for that if I had known that. Well, he went through training camp and did great, and then jumped into Normandy on D-Day with the 101st.
Wow.
Had a heck of a first day, June 6th, where he was in a French farmhouse with 14 wounded American soldiers. Mm-hmm. They surrounded it and captured them. They dragged Father Sampson out, lined up against a wall, and were ready to shoot him. Father Sampson later said, I knew I was going to die, so I wanted to say the act of contrition, which in the Catholic faith is, you're sorry for your sins, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. He said, but I couldn't remember the words to the act of contrition, so I said the grace before meals. bless us, O Lord, and these, I guess, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. Well, a German officer ran up and stopped the execution. The German officer was a Catholic himself. Yeah. Father Sampson went on to then help this other soldier named Fritz Nyland find his brother. Fritz Nyland jumped into Normandy on D-Day. His brother landed at Normandy on D-Day and was killed that day. Yeah. And Fritz Nyland wanted to find his brother, Richard Nyland. Mm-hmm. So Father Sampson went to the cemetery to help him find the grave. And Sampson came across a Nyland, but the name was Preston Nyland. And he shouted to this other Nyland, hey, I found a Nyland, but it's not the brother you're looking for. Well, this was a second brother of his who had been killed the day after D-Day. Then Private Nyland learned his third brother, the week before, had been shot down and was missing in the Pacific. Father Sampson helped him get home because of the loss of so many from one family. Their family became the basis, in part anyway, for Saving Private Ryan. Hmm. Steven Spielberg used that family as one of five or six to fashion that particular story.
Right.
Father Sampson then went on to the Battle of Bulge, where he was captured and spent the rest of the war in a German prison camp. So a lot of these guys and two gals became prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm. But you can still, oddly, a chaplain can still do his work as a POW.
Yeah, actually they may have had it a little better, but they pretty much experienced the same conditions. They could do their work, but they still suffer from the lack of food and beans and, Father Duffy was beaten a number of times in prison camp, and they all lost a lot of weight. you know, the usual story.
Yeah.
And, but yes, they could still mostly do what they wanted. In Japanese prison camps, some of their commandants, the crueler ones, would not let them say mass and distribute communion.
Mm-hmm.
But others allowed that. They would use maybe an eye drop of wine for mass instead of a chalice filled with mass, obviously, filled with wine. And so they still kept doing their duties as much as they could, and as, you know, battling the ravages of disease and whatnot that they as well experienced.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the effects of war that we talked about earlier, you know, the alcohol and things, the main effect was that the illnesses, they continued to battle for some time after the war because of the poor conditions in prison camp.
Mm-hmm.
That they just had to keep fighting that.
Yeah, I could see that. Did you come across any Bibles or crosses or anything that they had or used during the war?
The archives has Father Barry's Silver Star, a Bible that one of the other chaplains used. They had a bunch of photographs. I mean, I was so delighted to come across those. I had my choice of a couple hundred photographs, or more than that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, but as far as pure artifacts, there weren't too many. There was one when the paratroopers landed at Los Baños to free those Americans from that Japanese prisoner of war camp.
Mm-hmm.
One of the paratroopers was from Notre Dame, a soldier. And he hurriedly wrote a note in pencil to the superior at Notre Dame saying, "Hey, we just rescued your six missionaries. They're okay, blah, 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 blah." That note is in the archives at Notre Dame.
Mm-hmm.
A note from Father Duffy when the Japanese forced him to give a radio address. He had to write out what he was going to say. That's in the Toledo Archdiocese archives. All of his material is down in Toledo, Ohio, because that's the diocese he served. So those would be the only artifacts as such.
Mm-hmm. So, what did you find most enjoyable about this research?
Oh, reading these letters, unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Normally I would say interviewing veterans, but none of the chaplains was still alive when I came across this idea. And, you know, they were 10 years older than soldiers generally. And normally I would say interviewing, but since they were gone, coming across all these letters and reminiscences, it was like the next best thing to having the person sitting down with you and saying, "Here's what it's like."
Mm-hmm.
So I spent hours reading those and taking notes and enjoying every minute of it.
Yeah, just
do it. I'm an archive rat for all my books. I could spend hours in an archives and have a blast.
Yeah.
But this was the most fun of all, this particular project, because of these letters and photographs. And because it's a story a lot of people don't know. I mean, corpsmen, you know, medical corpsmen, it gets some notice, not as much as they should.
Mm-hmm.
But chaplains tend to be overlooked. But man, what a job these guys did. I mean, going way back to the George Washington or Ulysses S. Grant, George Marshall, they all say a chaplain is worth 20, 30, 40 soldiers because of how much they boost morale.
Mm-hmm.
They're there to give the soldier hope that they're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Even though everyone knows not everyone's going to be okay, that just the existence of a chaplain boosts a unit's morale.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been so overlooked, I think, in movies and in anything. You don't see too much about a chaplain. And it would be nice if that could change. But at least this book will bring some notice to this group of chaplains, mm-hmm. and let people know this remarkable role that they played in the war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how they could keep doing that and go out onto a battlefield under fire and ignore the bullets and tend to someone who's dying.
Yeah.
How you do that? I mean, obviously you do. Corbin does that too.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, you know, a bullet doesn't know, whoops, that's a chaplain, I can't hit him.
Right.
The bullet just goes. And these guys shrugged it off somehow and just did it.
Yeah. What did you find that was most surprising in your research?
Probably that human aspect of it, and just that they were sort of like the rest of everybody else, and that, you know, we have our fears and our hopes and our dreams. So did they.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Father Barry admitted to being scared. He said, "I've got to go up to the front tonight. Mm-hmm. I've got to. It's 10 o'clock, and my boys need me up there." So I'm scared, but I've got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the universal mention by every chaplain from Notre Dame of how's things on campus. They always ask about things on campus, like, you know, the Golden Dome, but the grotto, a religious place there, the beautiful lakes. There's two small lakes on campus. And every one of them always asked, "And how's the football team doing?" I mean, every single one. Always somewhere in there, "Hey, did the Irish beat Michigan? Or did the Irish do this? Or, hey, my soldiers are teasing me. We got beat by whoever," that kind of thing. So I thought, yeah, they're just like all the rest of us. I'm always wondering how Notre Dame is doing, or our favorite college for me is Notre Dame.
Mm-hmm.
And so they followed sports, and they worried about their parents. What will my parents be thinking of me being here on the battlefield? How is this affecting mom and dad, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes maybe we think of religious people in any faith, not just the Catholic faith, as somehow apart from us,
mm-hmm.
but they're not.
Right.
They're the same. They're just like everyone else. They just have a different job.
Mm-hmm.
End of story. And that, I guess, is what maybe surprises with the word. It really struck me, though. And when I thought about it, I thought, yeah, it makes sense that they would be that way.
Mm-hmm.
So the humanness angle of a chaplain, of a religious person. You know, like one of the nuns in prison camp, she was as feisty a character as you could have. She didn't take anything from Japanese. She went back down, and she was a real pistol.
Mm.
And I got a charge out of that.
Mm-hmm.
So those would be the bigger surprises, I suppose.
Was there a particular issue you were trying to get an answer for that just took a little while, maybe more than most, or something that you still would like to know that you didn't figure out?
Not really, no. I would have loved to have been able to ask these people directly a few questions,
mm-hmm.
that I couldn't get from letters, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Because Father Barry pretty much answered everything, you know, how you feel about this and how you feel about that, but most of them didn't get as deep as he did.
Mm-hmm.
They were very perfunctory letters, some of the chaplains.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to ask them some about some other issues as well.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe ask specifically, did you experience post-traumatic stress disorder of some sort?
Mm-hmm.
Because that obviously didn't come out. So that would be the only thing. But everything else, you know, just sort of answered itself as you go through research. And I didn't have a preset list of questions I hoped to have answered. I just, okay, let's see where this journey takes us. You know, what path will I go along on this? Mm-hmm. Let the story write itself in that way.
Interesting. With all the World War II footage out there, I wonder if any of it caught any of them in the field. That just no one was able to identify who, you know, where's that priest from? Who is he? You know, I wonder if that's out there. Well, I'm sure it is, but I wonder if how much.
By who is that? Well, I'm not. I don't follow that question.
Just, you know, newspapers taking footage, you know, journalists taking footage of people on the front lines and
Or
not on the front lines necessarily, but maybe in the rear, you know, catching footage of them, you know, because there's all this footage out there, and a lot of people aren't identified, you know, in it.
Right. And unfortunately, I was able to get enough pictures where they are identified. Mm-hmm. Of some of these chaplains, including Father Barry, saying mass in a field, mm-hmm. or on the hood of a Jeep, hearing confessions. The picture on the front of the book is of Father Dupuy at Saipan, hearing the confessions of Marines.
Mm-hmm.
There are no pictures of them under fire as such.
Mm-hmm.
But there aren't, that, you know, other than a documentary of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
There are not many pictures of infantry under fire, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But no, you're right. Certainly not on the priests that I came across anyway.
Because it makes me want, you know, when you read such intimate thoughts of these people, it just makes me wonder, you know, curious to see them in motion, you know, if they did video interviews later or anything like that. You know what I'm saying? Just seeing that.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't come across any. That would have been fun, yeah. I came across interviews, but they were all in print form.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing where I saw anything or heard anyone's voice. That would have been special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was just curious about that.
Sure.
So you mentioned a number of things that emotionally moved you. Is there any other stories or incidents that moved you strongly, either positively or negatively?
Positively, the one time when Father Barry, again, this was in Italy, the night before the men were to go into battle, this one soldier came up to talk to Father Barry alone. And he said, you know, Father, I'm going to go into action tomorrow. And he said, I'm not afraid of dying. He said, I just want to be able to have someone tell my parents, if I do die, that I was a good soldier, that I did my duty. He said, and he talked for a long time about that, you know, what it meant for the soldier to do his duty. And Father Barry basically just listened. He said, I didn't try and talk him out of it. I said, you'll be okay. So the soldiers know the story. Mm-hmm. They know you're just going to be giving them a line if you do that. And so I just let him talk, and then said, you know, you just go and do what you think you're supposed to do. And they left it at that. Well, the next day, the battle happened, and the soldier was mortally wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Father Barry was at his side, holding him in his arms as his soldier was dying, and with, you know, battle still raging about him, Father Barry whispered in his soldier's ear, remember what we talked about last night? Well, here it is, and I can say you were a good soldier. That struck me. That affected me. You know, a priest in the midst of battle whispering that into a dying soldier's ear, you were a good soldier. I don't know, but for some reason that really got to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I certainly included that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
The part where the one chaplain was giving last rites to the other Notre Dame chaplain on the hell ship,
mm-hmm.
was powerful as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, there were a lot of little episodes that were touching in the way they were thinking of the soldiers, trying to maybe get a birthday cake for them on the wartime front, you know, if they could. find a local Italian family who would make a rudimentary cake for a soldier who Father Barry thought really needed it to boost his morale. Those were the touching moments. Father Burke, who was aboard the battleship Pennsylvania when just a few days before the war ended in August of 1945, his ship was hit by a Japanese torpedo, killed 20-some men. Well, the letters that he had to write home, as you say, he made copies of them. Those are all in the archives. Those were quite powerful. You know, how do I write this? Because every chaplain went through that feeling. That was maybe their hardest job. How do I write the families of those who died? What do I say to them? And am I doing any good with these letters? Well, he composed stuff. He had an introductory paragraph and a closing paragraph that was largely the same in all the letters. But in the middle is where he personalized it for each man who died, just to give them their families some kind of information. And he received replies to those where the families said, "We're so grateful that you took time to write us and to know that our son had a religious person celebrating a mass, saying a mass in his honor, or that a chaplain was with him when he died," that kind of a thing. Those were powerful moments as well.
So you mentioned some of what you hope the book will do, you know, make people more aware of the sacrifices and efforts of these chaplains. Can you expand on that or maybe discuss other things you'd like to see come out of this book for readers?
Yeah, the sacrifices, I mean, these guys were used to sacrifice. You know, the religious life is a pretty tough life. And the Congregation of Holy Cross is a religious community, so they take a vow of poverty and therefore technically do not own anything. They sacrificed a great deal before the war, and this added to it, where they didn't have much money to do anything. If they needed some, they had to write their superior for permission for a few extra bucks, that kind of a thing. And so the sacrifice from missing their families, their parents, their sisters, and things like that, they sacrificed just as much as the infantry or sailors did. It's just they weren't married, basically. In so many ways, they were like a soldier who wasn't married. The soldier's job was to fight. The chaplain's job was to tend to those men who fought. And so, the normalcy of the chaplain, the humanness of the chaplain. And it was the humanness of it all that just made itself so evident to me as I dug deeper and deeper into the story.
So can you talk to any difficulties you had in finishing the book or getting it published and how you overcame those?
No, everything went smoothly. I went to Notre Dame Press, and they were delighted to have it. A chaplain book is, again, something that's different than most books about World War II or any conflict. There aren't that many out there like this. There were more than I thought, I suppose, but that's when you count all the wars together. But something like this is totally, I think, unique. And so Notre Dame Press was happy to have it because it's about Notre Dame people and about an angle that has not been covered at all. So there were no issues in lining them up as a publisher and no permission issues in any way. It was as smooth a project, I guess, as you could foresee, although I generally haven't encountered many problems in any of my projects, any of my books. If you have a good story, publishers will take a look at it. And once you get one published, then they're more apt to take a look at your second, third, and fourth ideas, etc. So it was a an easy one. It took a while, only because I was doing some other books at the same time with major publishers like DeCapo Press or Penguin or whatever. Mm-hmm. And those were the books where you get a decent advance and things like that. With a university press, you're not going to get that. Mm-hmm. And so I would do that sort of in my spare time and go back to campus and do the research. So it took a little bit longer than normal, but that was no problem for me because it was so much of a fun story to work with.
Mm-hmm. What's your next writing project?
I'm just finishing up. It's due Halloween, actually. It's the tentative title is Last Dogfight Over Tokyo. Hmm. I don't know if they're going to keep that title or not. But it's a book about the last four guys to die in World War II.
Hmm.
They were naval aviators flying off the aircraft carrier Yorktown off the coast of Japan in July and August of 1945. And as the war neared its end, especially after the atom bombs were dropped, these pilots, they didn't want to go up on any more missions. You know, they knew the war was going to end. We dropped a couple atom bombs. It was just a matter of time before Japan capitulated. And yet they kept being ordered out on more missions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on the last day of the war, August 15th, this one group of fighters from the carrier Yorktown took off toward targets near Tokyo. They were over the targets when they got the call back from the carrier, "Hey, abort, come back to the carrier, the war is over." So they turned around and were on their way back to the Yorktown when Japanese fighters jumped them and shot down four of the guys. And they died. And so technically they took off from the carrier in wartime, but were shot down in peacetime because the Japanese had agreed to surrender while they were over Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we're calling them the last four men to die in the war. It was the last mission, a wartime mission, where people were killed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's certainly many thousands of men who died in the decades after the war, as a result of their wounds from the war.
Right.
And so they are obviously World War II casualties. But this is an actual wartime mission and people who died in it. This was the last one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
So that's been a fascinating one, too. So
wow.
I'll hand that in October and get through the process of getting that published for next year. I think spring of next year is what they plan.
Okay. So where can people find your books and your writings if you happen to have social media presence or anything?
Yeah, they can go to my website, which is johnwukowicz.com, you know, myname.com, and they can order any books there. They can go to Amazon and order any of my books,
mm-hmm.
BarnesandNoble.com,
mm-hmm.
The actual bookstores, although that number is declining as we speak, I suppose.
Yeah.
So any of the normal outlets, Notre Dame Press would have it.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to inscribe copies, they should just go to my website and they can order any one of my books. There's a page that I have that has all the books, and they just send me a message with which book and to whom to inscribe the book, and we'll take it from there.
Okay. And just, I'll spell your name, JohnWukowicz, correct?
That's correct, yeah, that's right.
.com.
That'll do it.
So that's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, that was great. Very extensive interview, fantastic questions. I had a blast doing it.
Okay, yeah, so did I. Thank you. Thank you for listening. One of the best ways to provide feedback on this podcast is to rate it on iTunes. Please let me know if you liked it, or give me a poor rating if you didn't like this podcast, and I can use that feedback to hopefully get better. Otherwise, please follow me on Instagram at Chris Alvarez War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, on Twitter at War Scholar, on Facebook under War Scholar, and you can find more information on my website, warscholar.org. Please remember, my name, Chris, does not have an H, so it's CRISALVAREZ. Thank you, and I hope you continue to enjoy this podcast.